From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, did the Great Lakes Compact anticipate a project like the Foxconn factory?
The authors of the compact are telling me that none of them envision a 13,000 employee factory landing right on top of the Great Lakes Basin and challenging the compact language in unanticipated ways.
Later, our sports contributor tries to make sense of the frequently frustrating Milwaukee Bucks.
Maybe they're just this team. Maybe they need someone else to take them to that next level. Maybe they just need to wait until the end of the season and find someone who is able to get the best out of all these guys at the same time. I don't know.
And regardless of who they root for, what makes some people into obsessive sports fans? Lake Effect is next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. A plan to supply water to the future Foxconn manufacturing facility is scheduled to undergo public scrutiny on Wednesday. Leaders of the Taiwan-based company say the factory will require a great deal of water, which has raised the alarm of many environmentalists. A lot of water is required in the LCD screen production process, and the Racine Water Utility would like to supply the resource, but that desire presents a challenge.
The water utility would pipe Lake Michigan water from the Great Lakes Basin across Racine County into the Mississippi River Basin that eventually drains into the Gulf of Mexico. The Great Lakes Compact, which was enacted in 2008, governs such diversion requests, and in this case, Racine needs to get permission from the Wisconsin DNR.
Journalist Peter Annan is an expert on the Great Lakes Compact. He authored The Great Lakes Water Wars, closely followed the city of Waukesha's diversion application, and is keeping his eye on the Foxconn story as well. He tells Lake Effect Susan Bentz this diversion request raises a new set of questions.
Well, I think that, you know, after all the kind of hand-wringing about litigation over Waukesha, it seems like Foxconn is actually more vulnerable to litigation because the authors of the compact that I'm interviewing disagree with each other about what the straddling community water diversion language means in the compact. And some tell me that a factory like this on the edge of the basin was not intended at all, and others are telling me that it's just fine. And so when you have the authors of a legal document disagreeing about what it means, that is just ripe for litigation. The question is there anybody out there who's upset enough about Foxconn and has the resources to challenge the facility in court?
Each state has enabling rules that they crafted and are part of their state statutes, right?
Yeah, so the you know, with a straddling county application like Waukesha, all eight governors need to sign off on that unanimously, as you know. With a straddling community application, it's actually the local governor alone who has the power to make the decision about a water diversion of that sort. The other jurisdictions can voice an opinion, but they actually don't have a say over the decision, unless, of course, one of the other jurisdictions, one of the other states, decides to file a suit, which is not anticipated at this point, but we're still in the early stages. And it is worth noting, I think, that both the state of Michigan and the state of Ohio were trying to lure Foxconn to their states as well. So, and, you know, I think those two states in particular are jurisdictions that people are thinking about or wondering about. And then, of course, Michigan is 99.9% entirely in the Great Lakes Basin. So Foxconn would not be having an issue like this if it were in the state of Michigan.
It's fascinating, really.
It really is fascinating. And, you know, I mean, there people on all sides that I'm talking to are just fascinated by all the unanticipated questions that have come up because of this Foxconn facility. I mean, they're telling me, the authors of the compact are telling me that none of them envisioned a 13,000 employee factory landing right on top of the Great Lakes Basin and challenging the compact language in unanticipated ways.
Under the compact, are we looking at both drawing the water from the basin, but also the quantity and the quality of the water that's returned?
Yeah, it's a water quantity and a water quality issue. But I think that the bigger uncertainty at this point is actually the water quantity issue and the challenges that this may pose to the language in the Great Lakes Compact. I just don't think we know enough about what the water quality implications are going to be. The factory isn't even built yet. They're still talking about, as I understand it, Foxconn is still talking about, low reductions in its discharges, which would be higher consumptive use. And so that's a great question, but I don't think we know enough on the water quality side yet about how the facility will work and what it will do and what its discharges will be. But it's definitely, I can say this, that this the Foxconn facility definitely raises water quality and water quantity questions. I think the biggest question right now that we can raise is that there are issues about water quantity rules and regulations of the Great Lakes Compact that are going to be tested by Foxconn in unanticipated ways.
So you've said that the crafters of the compact had large industries like Foxconn in mind as it crafted the compact. Is that right?
That's right. The idea under the compact is we don't want to send our water in the Great Lakes region to jobs somewhere else. The idea under the compact is that those jobs should come to the Great Lakes where the water is. Keep the water here, let the jobs come here. But the idea under the compact was that those jobs would land cleanly and squarely inside the Great Lakes Basin. You know, when they threw the Foxconn dart, it landed right on top of the line in the Great Lakes Basin. And that was not anticipated by the drafters of the compact that I have interviewed. And so now they're looking back at the language, and there is a debate, as I said, among the authors of the compact about whether or not it allows or does not allow a large factory like this to be granted a water diversion under the Great Lakes Compact Straddling Community Exception Clause. The fine print issue is that there's a clause in the compact that says straddling community water diversions should serve, quote, a group of largely residential customers.
Right. And that is that in the compact itself or in Wisconsin state statute or both?
Both.
Okay. You won't be here for the hearing.
Unfortunately not.
Peter, you're dropping the ball.
They accidentally scheduled this hearing on Great Lakes Day in Washington, D.C., when the vast majority of all the environmental advocates in the Great Lakes are going to be in Washington. Now, they told me that was an accident, but and I believe them.
It seems a little suspicious to me.
They're kind of in a lose-lose. Either they were so obtuse that they didn't realize they were doing it, or they did it on purpose. And I believe them that they were too obtuse to realize that they did it. But nevertheless, they are holding the hearing on a day when the vast majority of the environmental advocates throughout the Great Lakes region are going to be marching the halls of Washington, lobbying on behalf of the Great Lakes. And the optics are not good for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources on that one.
Wow. So is there another point in this proposal that you feel is important to think about as people grapple with how they weigh in on it?
Yes. The Foxconn proposal is also testing new ground on consumptive use. And, you know, the water diversion applications under the Waukesha-like situation or the Foxconn situation, the compact has said that there's an allowance for consumptive use. And people like Dan Dukniak and Waukesha and authors of the compact have told me in the past that was always sort of like 5-10% of the total diversion amount. And then one of the sort of the public relations coups that Waukesha did is it agreed to return 100% of the water, even though the compact didn't require it.
Right.
Right. Well, Foxconn is going to be consuming about 40% of its water diversion. And so I've been asking those compact authors, you know, what is an allowance for consumptive use? Is it 40%? Is it 50%? I mean, it can't be 100%. So what is the percentage? And they're kind of giving me doe-eyed looks. And because, again, this is sort of an unanticipated situation, according to the authors of the compact. And, again, it would be really interesting to go back and ask Dan and what he was hearing privately from people about what the allowance for consumptive use was. I'm pretty sure he told me he thought it was 90% needed to be returned and they could have 10, 15%. Because there's leaks in pipes when you're trying to return the water, you know, that I&I it's called.
Right, right.
And stuff like that. And so that's traditionally that's what I was told the consumptive use thing meant. And now we have a facility. Clearly, facilities are going to factories are going to consume a lot of water. But again, the idea was that these factories would be entirely inside the Great Lakes Basin. So there's really two issues. One is the compact seems to suggest that a diversion of this sort should be primarily for residential, and this is clearly primarily for commercial. And secondly, it's consuming 40% of the diversion, according to the application, and that also has not been tested under the Great Lakes Compact yet. And so there's a couple of precedent-setting things here, which is why the application is more vulnerable to litigation than say, Waukesha was, because these are two untested areas, and the authors of the compact themselves are in a disagreement about what the language means. And so that doesn't mean a litigant could win and have Foxconn thrown out, but long-term, large-scale capital investment hates uncertainty. And litigation over gray areas in the Great Lakes Compact could bring a cloud of uncertainty over the Foxconn facility and could have a chilling effect on their enthusiasm to develop their facility here in Wisconsin. I don't know if that's going to happen, but the possibility is there. And things are moving so quickly, it's hard to tell which way things are going to go.
So I know you've said that Great Lakes governors or the council would likely weigh in on this. Do you know if it's on an agenda?
Well, the next big meeting of the Compact Council is in Duluth in June. And as far as I know, the agenda has not been set for that. But I have been talking to people who are going to be there, and they would be shocked if it didn't come up.
Peter Annan co-directs the Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College in Ashland, Wisconsin. He spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz about Racine's request to divert Lake Michigan water for the Foxconn manufacturing facility, which is slated to be built in the village of Mount Pleasant.
The Department of Natural Resources scheduled a Wednesday evening public hearing about the plan in Sturtevant. You'll find details at WUWM.com.
We'll take a short break and then learn about an author's life-changing visit to a book club reading her work. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. We feature a lot of books on Lake Effect. Many of them are the subjects of discussion among the scores of book clubs in the area.
Lake Effect essayist Marnie Maminga is the author of one such book. She recalls the unique circumstances surrounding a talk she gave to the members of one Wisconsin book club.
The homeless book club may sound like an oxymoron, but for those who participated, it was very real. With a warm room in a church as its meeting place, a retired doctor as its organizer, and the offering of hot coffee and egg sandwiches as nourishment, those who wanted to forget the wanderings of the street for 1 hour a week could join the Homeless Book Club. And many did. For not only did the Homeless Book Club offer a moment's rest from the struggles of the street, it also recognized those who were marginalized as being thinking, feeling human beings. It gave them an opportunity to speak and listen and discuss as the people they really were, a retired veteran, a mom, a professor, a truck driver, and not, as so many think, just another nameless person under a blanket on a bench. Through the generosity of others, the books the members chose to read were newly purchased and given to them to keep as their own. As an added bonus, the savvy director often invited the author of that month's selection to come and speak to them. I was one of those authors. I was honored that they had chosen my book, Return to Wake Robin, One Cabin in the Heyday of Northwoods Resorts, and eagerly began to prepare my book talk. And although I was excited, I was also a little nervous. What would this group be like? All the stereotypical images of the homeless began to haunt me. Unkept, addicted, or mentally unstable people of the street. If this were the case, would I be up to the challenge? Because of this anxiety, it wasn't until 2 days before my talk that the irony of my subject hit me. My book was not only about the history of a cherished family cabin on a lake, it was about a second home. This to a group of people who had no place to call home? Suddenly, everything about my presentation seemed wrong, insensitive, even hurtful. But it was too late to back out now. The director had kept me abreast of the group's progress and reported that over the course of several weeks, they had already read and discussed the book, prepared questions to ask me, and were looking forward to my visit. I couldn't let them down now. And so, on the chilly morning of my presentation, I nervously climbed the steps to the third-floor meeting room of the church and, with butterflies in my stomach, walked in. "She's here!" someone shouted, and suddenly the room burst into applause. You would have thought I was some rock star instead of a middle-aged Midwestern author with her first book in hand. There were at least 20 in attendance, including a few extra guests, and as they enjoyed their hot coffee and egg sandwiches, I set up my materials and took the opportunity to discreetly look over the group. Some were old, some young. Mostly they were men, but there were also a few women sprinkled in. All were neat and clean and chatting amicably with each other. So much for the power and fear of stereotyping. Gripping the hot coffee they had politely offered me, I took a deep breath and began my talk. I could not have had a more attentive audience. They smiled back at me as I spoke, laughed at my attempts at humor, and listened intently. No one fell asleep, which I must admit has not always been the case. When I began to read from a selected chapter, the young man sitting next to me opened his book and helped the man sitting next to him follow along by pointing to each word with his finger. This gentle act of kindness continued throughout the entire reading. I had to concentrate hard to hold back tears, for they reminded me of my own sons when they were young and learning to read. Had lack of strong reading skills contributed to these young men's homelessness? I could only wonder. When I finished my talk, the group went around the room and one by one asked me questions they had prepared. In doing so, many also shared wonderful memories of happy times when they had gone to a lake or a cabin or camping, a poignant reminder to them and to me that they had not always been homeless. And then came the zinger. "Were you afraid to come here?" one of the last to speak asked. I hesitated for just a moment. "Yes," I said. "Why?" he countered. "I guess I didn't know what to expect, and I was worried I would hurt you, talking about a precious vacation home to me when you are homeless." They nodded quietly in understanding, and in that moment, we were not the homeless and the author. We were on common ground, each seeking to understand and be understood. Over the last few years, whenever I see a homeless person on the street curled up on a bench, I often think of the Homeless Book Club and wonder how my friends are doing and what they are reading. But most of all, I think of them, of their dignity, of the kindness they showed to a nervous visitor and to each other, and of the strength to try and change their circumstances. And I am humbled by the lessons they taught me.
Lake Effect essayist Marnie Mominga is the author of two books, including Return to Wake Robin.
Our sports contributor looks ahead to the Brewers' season on the way and asks what makes the Bucks so frustratingly inconsistent. That's coming up when Lake Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. There might still be melting snow on the roof of Miller Park, but there are a lot of baseball fans eager to get through March. Baseball spring training is underway, and there are some high hopes among the loyal Brewers rooters in town.
But how well placed are those hopes? Lake Effect sports contributor Sean Ranft joins us to look ahead at what we might expect from the 2018 rendition of the Brewers. Hi, Sean. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So we are at the point of the baseball season where everybody has a chance to win the World Series except for the Miami Marlins.
Yes.
So let's talk about the Brewers, who a lot of people, I don't know if people are picking them as a World Series contender, but certainly on this very show, we talked about them as a divisional contender. They have really shored up in a lot of places going into the season. Let me start with an interesting question, and that is, why is Ryan Braun going to be spending time at first base this year?
Because they have too many outfielders that need at-bats, that deserve at-bats, and they can't split that up evenly right now unless they make a move. And I know fans have, you know, said, oh, Braun can just play first base for the last couple of years, but that never was really that feasible. He was an atrocious third baseman. Which it's not the same at all, but he was an atrocious corner infielder. Before.
And right, he only played that really his first year.
Yeah, his first season. He played it in college. He played it in his first season, and he was not good. And he will probably be serviceable at first base, but then you run into the other issue of, we just mentioned it with outfielders, they have two other first basemen that also deserve at-bats and got at-bats last year and were very productive.
Two other first basemen who together had, what, something like 50 home runs?
Yes. Aguilar and Thames, which was a pretty solid platoon with the righty-lefty. And I know they want to do that with Braun and Thames, but what do you do with Aguilar now?
I think the Brewers perhaps are deep down hoping they'll be sent back to the American League and somebody can DH.
It's a good plan. I don't know if it'll work, but that seems to be what they would need at this point.
So you got Aguilar, you got Thames, you have Braun. Take us back to the outfield for a minute and remind us why things are so crowded there.
Okay, so they signed Lorenzo Cain, but about 30 minutes before that was announced, they traded for Christian Yelich from the Marlins, and that gave them six major league outfielders. They still have Brett Phillips, who I know he has an option year for the minors, but he should be playing every day. If that means, I guess, going back to AAA, then that might have to be what he does. But they also have Domingo Santana, who broke out offensively and statistically was their best offensive player last season. He's suddenly not guaranteed to start every day. That's kind of an issue. Keon Broxton has a lot of potential, base-stealing threat, power threat, very good defensively, but he's not a starter in this current lineup. So, and he also has an option year, but you don't want him in the minors either. It's just they have too many. It's a good thing to have depth, but they don't have enough at-bats to go around when you're looking at it right now.
Which raises the question, where are they at their most shallow?
I still think starting pitching. And some of that might be a little overblown, but Jimmy Nelson's coming back from a pretty serious surgery that the starting pitchers who have had it in the past don't really do well from once they come back. It's not like a Tommy John thing where you don't want them to have it, but that's like best case scenario these days for starting pitchers. And then after that, you have Chase Anderson, who broke out last year, hopefully more of the same. Zach Davies a little bit broke out last year. I mean, I know they won a lot for him when he was on the mound, but that wasn't because he was fantastic constantly. They scored a lot of runs for him, and he pitched well as the season went on.
That's an interesting question, you know, that I don't know that anybody's ever been able to satisfactorily answer. Why is it that some teams score more runs for some pitchers than others?
Yeah, I don't understand it. The first half of the year, I remember remarking that he was basically the 2017 version of Braden Looper, who was giving up a ton of home runs, but the Brewers were scoring six or seven runs for him each start, and he ended up winning like 16 or 17 games. That's not the exact number, but he won.
Right, a guy who wins 15 games, but his ERA is 4.8.
Exactly. Yeah. And for the first half, that's what Davies was, and then he got a lot better in the second half. If he keeps pitching that way, that's fantastic, but you still only have Chase Anderson and Davies at the top. You don't know what you're going to get from Junior Guerra. He had a really rough second season last year. He seems to be healthy this year, and he's looking sharp so far. But otherwise, Chacin, you hope that free agent signing. You hope the ground balls come into play because you don't want to be giving up home runs in Miller Park. It's a hitter's park, and he's a ground ball pitcher, so hopefully that'll work out. But it's a lot of middle to back end of the rotation pitchers that they have right now.
Right.
You don't know what step Woodruff is going to take. I know they have prospects still in the minors, but you would like one more big name. And there are names available. There's Alex Cobb, there's Lance Lynn, there's Jake Arrieta still. So they could make a move, or they could also trade one or two of their outfielders if they are willing to do that, which last time on the show, I assumed they would, and then nothing happened. So that's where we are now.
And middle infield?
Middle infield, they seem pretty well set. VR, hopefully VR bounces back. RC is their shortstop. That's not going to change. I don't think they're going to go after Neil Walker and re-sign him, even though he was a nice offensive presence at the end of last season. Hernan Perez will play a bunch. I mean, they have so many position players, which is not a bad thing. That's never a bad thing. But they should be. They seem to be short. They have shored up their outfield. They have enough platoons for first base and the outfield. They have maybe too many, I guess. But Travis Shaw is at third base. They have all their other infielders can play third base pretty much.
It seems like we're in a situation in Milwaukee where they really do have a surplus of position players such that if the time and the place and the other team was right, they might be able to bring another pitcher over.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure GM David Stearns is actively talking with teams. I'm sure they're not just sitting on their hands and, oh, well, we're stuck with
beautiful day
these
in Maryvale.
Yep.
And
just going to stick with all these position players. But if they don't feel the price is right, then I get it. I know a few weeks ago, the Rays were really reluctant to let Chris Archer go, but then they got rid of everybody else within the span of a week and a half, and mostly for cutting salary reasons. They designated an all-star, a 2017 all-star for assignment. They traded Oda Rizzi to the Twins for, like, their fifth-best shortstop prospect, not their fifth-best prospect. So, I mean, the Brewers could have done something like that. It would have cost them nothing, but they apparently didn't feel Oda Rizzi would have helped, which is fine. They're smarter than I am. They know what they're doing. But, yeah, hopefully it's a little less cluttered by the time the regular season starts. And again, right now, today, we've got lots of time between now and opening day.
All right. So let's touch briefly on the Bucks for a minute here, because the Bucks, speaking of promising teams, are a promising team. And every time you think they've got it together, they go on a run where they lose two or three games in a row by two or three points.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some questions about, you know, what this team can really accomplish and what it needs to take them beyond the point where they get within a sniff of fourth place and suddenly they're back in seventh place.
Yeah, because the East is really cluttered from even third to eighth. Right. There's like three games separating everybody. It's maddening. They're inconsistent, and I feel like the last few years, or even longer than that, you see these flashes where they win games that maybe they shouldn't. They beat the Toronto Raptors in Toronto after the All-Star break by a point, and then they come home and blow an 18-point lead in the second half. And then on national television a couple nights later, they're down by 22 points in the first quarter. They battle back to lose by two or three, but that doesn't matter really. And then they come out and lose by almost 30. This was the last; those were their last four games.
Right.
They beat the best team in the East and then fell flat on their faces a couple of times. And I don't know what they need to do, because I feel like a lot of Milwaukee fans have been watching the same sort of team for the last decade or so. The only difference being is that they have a bona fide superstar in Giannis, and I don't know what the next step is. They have been.
They certainly seem like they have the supporting cast as well. Middleton, and you've got Jabari Parker, and you've got Eric Bledsoe.
Bledsoe's been a solid offensive boost. He makes a lot of silly mistakes, and I think Malcolm Brogdon wouldn't make those mistakes, but he's out
injured
right now,
yeah.
So that's a problem. they never seem to have everyone healthy at the exact same time, which every basketball team or sports team in general can say that.
The issue with having guys whose legs are 6 feet long, right?
Yeah. So there's that. But it's just you see these flashes, and they've played a lot of bad teams since they fired Jason Kidd. They have beaten all of those bad teams, though, and they weren't beating those bad teams consistently before. But they all five of their losses, I'm pretty sure, since they fired him, have been against playoff teams. And you have to start winning some of those games. If they either start too slow or they can't finish the game. They never have a complete game, it seems like, which is kind of an issue, obviously, at this level. And now they're almost in the eighth seed now. It's been a rough week and a half for them. The offense is there. They have offense. That's not a problem. Their defense is better since they fired Jason Kidd, but it could almost not get any worse from the time he was there. So I don't know. Maybe they're just this team. Maybe they need someone else to take them to that next level. Maybe they just need to wait until the end of the season and find someone who is able to get the best out of all these guys at the same time. I don't know. They have a lot of money tied up in big men, and none of them are particularly good. Henson's very solid defensively. He's also injured a lot. Thon Maker, while he's very young and he's very raw still, he has definitely taken a step back from last season, and that's not great.
Right. We see John Henson with a lot more playing time than Thon Maker these days.
And last season, by the end of the season, Thon Maker was getting a lot more minutes. So you hope it's just a rough slump and he can snap out of it. But it just seems like there's flashes. There's talent. It's all right there. But they just can't put it together for a long enough stretch for it to matter. At least their losses lately have been against better teams. But it's just been the manner of which they've been losing that's frustrating now.
Right, right. So. You know, so I want to ask you just a quick question about what kind of fan you consider yourself.
Okay.
You know, when you sit down and watch your team, and I don't know what your team, you know, if there's one single team you identify yourself with, what would it be?
I would say it would be the Brewers. It's baseball. But a very close second and maybe pushing into first would be Tottenham Hotspur in the English Premier League. I get very riled up during soccer matches now, to the point where when it comes to other sports, like, for instance, like Packers football, that takes a back seat. I don't get as animated. And even with the Brewers, I don't get as animated. My wife would disagree with that, especially this past season down the stretch. I took myself off of Twitter, off of social media, because that last stretch of games was just too much to be online for. So it's still the Brewers right now, but Tottenham's close.
So you watch a Tottenham game and Tottenham ends up beating Newcastle or something. And what do you think? What does it do to your psyche?
It makes me feel really good the rest of the day. A couple of days, I'm to the point now where I try not to let wins and losses affect the way I go about my life. I'm a little too old for that now. It's not a great feeling when, and I'm pretty sure the last time that I really let an event or an outcome ruin my day for a few days was the Packers-Seahawks NFC Championship game. That was just brutal. There's no other word for it. It was a rough, rough way to lose. And the last couple of days, I like canceled plans the next day. I didn't want to be around anybody for a couple of days. But that hasn't happened since. And I think that might have been my little wake up call where it's sports. I get into it, and with Tottenham, I still get into it, and the Brewers, I still get into it. But I can't let it affect how I live my life after that. Not anymore.
Sean Ramft, thanks.
Thanks so much, Mitch.
Sean Ramft is managing editor of the Sports Post website and our regular sports contributor.
Sean talked about the effect a win or loss by his favorite team can have on his psyche. After a break, we'll speak with the author of a new book about what makes some people positively obsess over sports teams. That's after one more break on Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Anyone who watches sports, either in person or on television, has seen them. Those are the fans sitting in Lambeau Field on a 15-degree December day with their shirts off, bodies covered in green and gold paint. Or maybe it's the guy driving down the street in a car painted in the Brewers color scheme.
The term fan doesn't seem adequate to describe how some people connect to a sports team. Writer George Dorman would have used the term superfan. Dorman is a Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer and the author of the new book, Superfans, Into the Heart of Obsessive Sports Fandom, a trip that connected him with two Wisconsinites who fall into that category. Dorman joins us via Skype from Oregon. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So what got you first thinking about the obsessive nature of some sports fans?
You know, I just think I've been a journalist, a sports journalist for a long time at Sports Illustrated, at newspapers, and you know, you interact with a lot of fans as a result of that. Fans who are happy you wrote something, angry you wrote something, fans who accuse you of bias, you know, all these sort of interesting interactions that you have. And it only feels like with social media and whatnot, we are hearing more from fans than ever. And so I just really wanted to gain a deeper understanding of the people that I was, you know, that I was hearing from all the time. And, you know, and also myself, because I'm a fan. So it was also a little bit of, even though I'm not really in the book, a little bit of understanding myself.
Well, right. I mean, you have been around this long enough, and you write about other people who kind of have experienced these same things. You write about Buster Olney, who, you know, turns out to be biased towards, you know, or against 28 of 30 Major League Baseball teams. Did you have a certain group of assumptions about these folks that brought you into this project?
I think that one thing, it was more of a curiosity, which was, you know, we sort of treat these people, like some of them at least, like circus freaks, right? It's like they're like behind this glass. They're these weird people. Maybe they're deranged. You know, we make judgments about them. And so I really thought, you know, that can't be true, right? These have to be normal people somewhat. So I went in it thinking, look, there has to be a normal side to these people. And that proved to be true. I think there was, on my end, you know, really a strong desire to get to know the people behind the face paint and the costumes and all that.
You do write about them with a fair amount of affection as you get to know them, which I think, you know, for people who were expecting this to be a freak show might come as a surprise. But, you know, there really is something endearing about just about everyone in this book.
Yeah, you know, I think that part of that comes from going out and seeing them and sitting down with them and not just focusing on their fandom, but also focusing on, tell me about your life, your wife, your husband, your job, your history. I mean, when you're talking to somebody who is, let's say, there's a woman in my book who is a, you know, just an insane Seattle Seahawks fan, like to the point that she has superstitions about what kind of Skittles she has next to her when she's watching the game, right? That on the face of it, and if you just talk to her about that, she comes across as a little bit off. But then you talk to her about her substance abuse problem. She was in an abusive relationship. Why she was drawn towards the Seahawks and why she embraces them so much. You can't help but look at that and offer at least a more balanced portrait of who these individuals are.
So the guy that seems pivotal to understanding what it means to be an intense sports fan is a man named Dan Juan. What does his research represent in this field?
Dan is at Murray State in Kentucky, and he's really the one guy who has been allowed to make a career out of studying fans. And he's been doing it for 20 plus years. It started when he was at a doctorate program at Kansas. So most fan researchers kind of do it as a sidelight, but Dan is the one guy who does it full time and has published, you know, over 100 papers about this. So this is the one guy, he's a social psychologist who spends, you know, most of his waking days or his professional waking days just thinking about researching and studying fans. So he is really the key to doing this. And one reason in particular, which is Dan developed a method to actually sort of rate fandom. We have this idea of how big a fan are you? People hear that all the time and there's contests and nonsense. Dan actually has a scientific approach how to do this. He has a test that he gives fans to show how strongly they identify with teams.
Right. It's called the Sports Spectator Identification Scale. And I was amazed. He apparently sketched it out, what, over dinner or something. It was really pretty. It came to him pretty easily.
Yeah. And it really changed the profession, because before Dan, all the researchers who did, research on fans, in Dan's words, number one, they didn't really like fans or weren't fans. Whereas Dan's a huge Kansas fan, a huge Murray State fan, a huge Royals fan. So that's the first part of it. And the second part of it is they treated all fans equally. If you're a fan of, the Green Bay Packers, you're just a fan. It's all the same. But what if you only watch the Green Bay Packers on Sunday with friends and don't think about them otherwise? You know, how is that fan the same as somebody who lives and dies with them all, every day, all week, reads every blog, writes his own blog, visits message boards, things like that? So what Dan brought to the research was the idea of treating every fan individually and getting a sense of how strongly each fan identified with the team.
The other part of his work that seems especially significant is he also helps pinpoint what or who is most responsible for turning people onto sports, right?
Yeah, and I think by doing so, he and some other research have shattered some of the myths we have about fandom. But, he goes out and he asks a lot of college students, typically college students, why did you become a fan? And what he found was that there's some obvious ones. Oh, my dad was a fan of that team, so I became a fan. Or my older brother was a fan of that team. But it goes way beyond that. And there are a myriad of reasons. And what you find is that people typically have many reasons for why they're a fan. Maybe they went to college there. Maybe their dad went there. Maybe they just liked birds growing up as kids and therefore became an Eagles fan, right? So he found out that really it's kind of complicated why people choose teams.
There's a Packers fan who kind of fits into this dynamic and kind of builds off of Dan's work. Where does Ted Peets come in?
Yeah, Ted is a Wisconsinite, and he then went into academia. He traveled around a lot, worked at different colleges. He's worked in Ohio, Iowa, Nevada. He's now at Belmont University in Tennessee. And he was somebody who, and people can relate to this, Packers fans certainly can, who every stop he went looking for other Packers fans to watch games with and to connect with. So he'd find that Packers bar in a tiny town in Ohio, right? Or find the big one, the Rum Runner in Las Vegas. And he started thinking about, why do I do this? What psychologically is going on here? And what does it bring to my life? And then, of course, he ran into Dan Wann at a conference. And Dan sort of brought him into his orbit, and they started crafting research, a research project around this. And so Ted went out and started, polling and testing, giving different tests and questionnaires to the Packer fans that he interacted with at bars, at one specific bar, but two bars actually, in Tennessee. And what he realized was that mostly what was happening with Packer fans was something called place attachment, which is that Packer fans really wish they were back in Wisconsin. And so when they are gathering outside a bar in Nashville and grilling brats, and tailgating at the bar before the bar opens, by the way, to then go inside and watch it. What they really just want the smells of home, the sounds of home, maybe the accents of somebody. They want to hear about home. And this is called place attachment. And it's something that's been studied. It was actually studied by a guy who studied Nebraska football fans. But Ted then took it a step further and said, hey, are Green Bay Packers fans happy when the off season? Is it in the off season, are they as happy as they are in the regular season? And he did all this work on it, and the conclusion was yes, that Packers fans, this place attachment, this connection that they make during the season, these groups that they form, creates a very lasting happiness.
Right. It's interesting. Like the research is there that shows sports fans are generally just happier people than non-sports fans.
And I think there's several reasons for that. One is, they create social groups. We're social individuals. We want to be part of groups. And so fan groups are these really interesting social groups that help us connect with people. Two, your team wins and you feel good. Your team signs a top free agent, you feel good.
Right. This is berging, right?
Yeah, exactly. You're basking in reflected glory. you know, what Dan and other researchers have found is that fans are happy people, that fandom, even pretty intense fandom, is not necessarily a negative thing. And for a lot of people, it's a real positive in their lives.
Although you do write about one researcher who writes with some concern about the age at which kids are exposed to their parents, generally their dad's fandom, and what it's teaching them.
This was a really eye-opening bit of research for me, diving into this notion of really getting into how do young children react to fandom, to being indoctrinated into a team. The boy in my book is in a Packers family. They live in Chicago, but they're huge Packers fans. The dad had season tickets, is from Wisconsin originally, but he grew up an Eagles fan because he loved birds. And, you know, we see him videos of him melting down as Tom Brady is beating his Eagles, a couple years ago. And what this researcher that I talked to, Susan Harder, who's a renowned child psychologist, talked about was how, you know, one problem with introducing kids to fandom is that they already want to see the world in black and white. Kids just naturally want good and bad. They want girl and boy. The example she used was a kid might say, is this a girl street or a boy street? And that's something that those of us who have kids can certainly understand, kids wanting that clarity, that very simplified black and white world. Well, fandom creates that for them, right? Alabama good, Auburn bad, right? You know, Notre Dame good, USC bad, or whatever you want to, you know, apply it to anything, right? We can do it. Bears good, Packers bad, that kind of a thing. And so the problem is kids embrace that wholeheartedly. And they also don't understand sort of any nuance to it. So the Eagles might finish, you know, with one loss during the regular season. They might make it to the Super Bowl and they might lose. But that kid is going to melt down. He's not going to understand, well, we had a good season overall, so it's okay. What was really fascinating to me was that this woman, this child psychologist, essentially said, we shouldn't be introducing fandom to our kids until adolescence. Because at that point, they can then understand, you know, daddy isn't really going to, you know, isn't really losing it. And they can understand that we had a good season despite the loss. And we have to understand that while we may not like Tom Brady, that doesn't make him, you know, evil and worth our scorn.
I'm also really interested in this concept of standing out but still fitting in, because you spent a lot of time with a Brewers fan who is actually known as Teddy Kervin, but better known as the Rally Banana, this guy who wears a banana costume to Brewers games. And you write that he is emblematic of this phenomenon of being the same and different at the same time.
Oh, I love Teddy Kervin. He is seriously, if I had to pick one fan in this book that I just like so much, it is him. Because this is like a bar owner's son from outside Milwaukee who he went to UW Milwaukee and he just, you know, kind of on a drunken lark with his college buddies started wearing this banana costume to games, and he ended up on TV across the country, you know, grabbing his love handles. And I mean, it's unbelievable. There's video out there. Any listener should go find it, you know, the Rally Banana on YouTube. But what Teddy is somebody who needs a high level of distinctiveness. And the way I describe it is all individuals have these two competing needs. One is to be part of a group, and the other is to stand out from the group. Some people don't need to stand out from the group much. They're happy being in the group, standing out very little or not at all, right? But other people really need to stand out from the group. They still want to be part of that group that is Brewers fans or Lakers fans or whatever. But they also, like, I'm an individual and I want to make sure everybody knows I'm an individual. And, you know, Teddy is a guy who competed in, like, competitive karaoke contests wearing nothing but a Speedo. This is clearly a man who has a high need for distinctiveness. So why does Teddy Kervin go to Brewers games and rip up his shirt and shake his belly and scream Rally Banana and do it on TV with his wife sitting next to him, by the way? And, like, why does he do this? And the answer is he's just somebody who really needs that distinctiveness, needs to stand out while also kind of fitting in. So, you know, this makes him happy. And so we can sit there and we can judge Teddy and we can say, my God, I would never do that. Well, I'm not somebody that needs that level of distinctiveness. But Teddy does. And he's doing no harm other than maybe kind of making us turn away from the TV every once in a while. But he is very happy. I mean, he has a great job. He's happily married. He's got the house, the dog, the whole thing. He is a happy guy. And that happiness, it comes in part from him having this very unique distinctiveness that he can express at Brewers games.
So you said you went into this project thinking about yourself as a sports fan. Did you come out of it understanding any more about where you come from as the sports fan that you are?
Yeah, several things. I mean, it definitely influenced that chapter we talked about introducing your child to fandom. I have kids 5 and 8, and it made me really think about differently about how much I will introduce them to my own fandom at this point. So I hide a little bit of my fandom from them. I watch games out of the house so they don't see me yelling at the TV or things like that. Just I don't want them to see that emotion from me, because they just can't understand that it's no big deal that dad's yelling at the TV. He's not really mad, you know? But I think a lot of little things. I think if the book succeeds with readers, I think it would be because readers will learn little things about themselves and about the people around them. And I've learned little things about, you know, I went to Notre Dame. Why do I downplay Notre Dame's chances before every game? I call my buddies and I'm sitting there thinking, oh God, you know, they got no chance against Michigan State. You know, there's no way. It's just another loss. Brian Kelly's terrible. Well, I'm preparing my self-esteem. I'm preparing myself for the blow that will come when, you know, so there's a lot of little things like that I learned about my own behavior, superstitions, you know, those kind of things that really have helped me. You know, I can now do something as a fan and go, oh, I'm doing this because for this reason.
Well, George Dorman, it's great stuff. And I think, honestly, a lot of people will recognize a little something of themselves in many parts of this book. So thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. It's been great.
George Dorman is senior editor of The Athletic, a former investigative reporter for Sports Illustrated, and the author of the new book Superfans, Into the Heart of Obsessive Sports Fandom. We reached him on the line from Oregon. So, Mitch, what is your obsessive fan?
You know what? I try not to throw more than one piece of furniture into the television set when the Red Sox lose.
And there you go. That wraps up Wednesday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thanks so much for tuning in today. And I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.